Welcome back to the Sunshine Edition from WLRN and Florida Public Radio, the 2015 Florida Legislature. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening. Tell us what's on your agenda for Florida lawmakers. Send us a tweet by using the hashtag Session2015. The 160 combined members of the State Senate and House officially get to work tomorrow in Tallahassee as that law writing session gets underway. But already there have been negotiating a number of thorny issues, especially health care. Florida remains on the list of states that has not accepted the federal expansion of Medicaid. Now, the program provides health care for the poor. The federal strategy to expand it was part of the Affordable Care Act, and it's gained wider acceptance in some places where it had been opposed. Indiana, for instance, recently approved an alternative Medicaid expansion. Last year, Governor Scott dropped his opposition, and Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell told us last month she remains optimistic for expansion in Florida.
With regard to Governor Scott, have had the chance to see him once face-to-face, and as always, you know, my conversations were positive and look forward to hopefully continuing those.
Many of the state's decisions on health care for the poor have been on hold as state and federal Medicaid officials negotiate over funding behind closed doors. Billions of dollars are potentially at stake, as Carol Gentry with Health News Florida reports.
When it comes to health care funding, Florida's in a funny position. The state has twice turned down billions of dollars from federal Medicaid that would have covered care for about 1 million poor Floridians. This year may be no different. State Representative Matt Hudson chairs the powerful committee in charge of health spending.
I don't believe for one moment that this is a good plan for Florida, and I would certainly not change my opinion that way.
At the same time, state legislators and Governor Rick Scott want federal officials to keep a special fund for hospitals and clinics that treat those same patients. It's called the low-income pool. It may seem inconsistent, but that's healthcare politics in Florida. Justin Senior is Florida's Medicaid director. He's watching the calendar as he negotiates with federal health officials over renewing the low-income pool. It expires June 30th.
In order for us to make any plans for expenditures on July 1st of this year, we really do need an agreement in principle from our federal partners sometime in late March or very early April.
The Medicaid budget that Governor Scott sent to the legislature includes more than $1 billion for the low-income pool. But federal Medicaid chief Elliot Fishman told business leaders in Orlando recently that the low-income pool, which he calls LIP, will not be renewed in its present form.
We extended the LIP for a year with the explicit purpose of moving to a significantly reformed payment system.
To get the money last year, Florida had to agree on an independent evaluation of its Medicaid payment program. Fishman says that report by the consulting company Navigant shows lots of flaws.
Florida's payment system is complicated, and far more so than payment systems in either Medicare or than payment systems in other states. That complexity leads to huge variation within the state in terms of the ratio of Medicaid payment to the cost of care.
In other words, the program pays way more to some health care providers than to others for the same service. Fishman says Florida can straighten out its payment problems if it expands coverage to the uninsured. 2 years ago, the State House turned down billions of dollars from the Affordable Care Act intended for that purpose. He says states that did expand are seeing immediate results. In just 1 year, they've seen steep drops in unnecessary ER visits and hospital admissions. In Florida this year, big business has added its heft to the push for the state to accept the Medicaid expansion money. That's at least $3 billion a year. The Senate may be open to the matter, but the House isn't. State Representative Kerry Pigman is a Republican from Sebring. He's also an ER doctor who chairs a panel on health quality.
It is dead on arrival.
It's dead, he says, unless the proposal looks a lot different from last time. It would need to give the state more control, use private insurance, reduce some benefits, and require more from Medicaid enrollees. Healthy behavior, co-pays, and willingness to work. Pigman says the House Republican caucus won't accept a demand to expand Medicaid in order to avoid a sudden cutoff of the low-income pool. It's unclear whether that will happen.
We believe the jury's still out with that. I believe there are some bureaucrats in Washington who don't want to cut Florida off abruptly. I think there are other bureaucrats in Washington who would like to punish us for not expanding Medicaid the way they want us to expand it.
Mark Delegal is an attorney with Holland & Knight. He represents the hospitals that will be hurt most if the low-income pool disappears. He feels certain an agreement will be reached, at least on that.
It is absolutely essential. Florida deserves it. Florida's relied upon it for over nearly 25 years in some form or fashion. And to pull it out and to eliminate it would not be sustainable for many, many, many hospitals.
Lawmakers will be watching both Medicaid funding issues when the session starts March 3rd. For Health News Florida, I'm Carol Gentry in St. Petersburg.
The effort to expand Medicaid has failed in past sessions in Tallahassee. Now hospitals in the state could lose more money with that expiration of that second safety net for low-income patients. Mary Ellen Kloss with the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times continues with us in Tallahassee, joined by Carol Wieser, director of the Leroy Collins Institute. Carol, first of all, what's at risk if there is no solution to this low-income pool, the LIP money that I believe is included in the governor's budget right now?
Yes, indeed it is. It's about it's over $1 billion. So this is a fair amount of money, and some of the extra money that the state is counting on would be gobbled up if we lost that money. Yeah, I thought the report was really quite excellent on this. This is really a standoff between the federal government and the state government, and the legislature is kind of in the middle here. And I think it's going to be, you know, they're both kind of standing their ground at this point.
Showdown in the last week of April, Mary Ellen. Does the governor have to flex his political muscle and cash in any political capital that he may have?
You know, he has not indicated a willingness to be doing that. And I think that we have the prospect here, and I've heard from many players about this, that we may not see this issue resolved this session. Mm. And I don't know exactly how they build a budget without it. But the governor, of course, put the money in his budget, and it's very likely that the legislature could do the same, just kind of punt and assume that it will be resolved. And here's what they're thinking. We've got U.S. Supreme Court is deciding the fate of the Obamacare, and in a challenge that's being made right now to the subsidies for states like Florida,
right,
that give subsidies to people who are on lower wage workers who now get Obamacare subsidies. That is going to be resolved by the end of this Supreme Court term, which would be the end of June. That's the same time that the money disappears from the federal government,
yep,
for the LIP funding. So we could be in a situation where
a lot of things coming
fate
to head.
Both of those things come to happen, and we have a special session in the summer.
That's right. Healthcare, it's a huge issue, obviously, for the future of thousands of Floridians. These Floridians work for local and municipal governments, counting on those governments for the retirement. Pension reform is also on the agenda in a big, big way. According to the Leroy Collins Institute, local governments in Florida have more than $8 billion of unfunded pension promises. Certainly, Jacksonville is watching this closely. Matt Carlucci is a former Jacksonville City Councilman, and Michael Hallett is a professor with the University of North Florida, joining us from our partner station WJCT in Jacksonville. Matt, what contributes to this $1 billion-plus hole that the Jacksonville Police and Fire Pension is seeing, and among those groups of unfunded health care and retirement benefits?
Well, over the years, the investments have decreased but we have a defined benefit program, which means you have to pay the benefits that are put together in a formula,
right?
But whether rates meet that or not.
Sure. Is it the pension payouts that are increasing this unfunded mandate, or
is it
the health care benefits?
What's really driving it is the COLA. Cost of living increase. It's 3% guarantee, and that's what's really driving it. That was instituted back probably a decade or so ago. And it's important to remember that that was instituted for two reasons. In Jacksonville's pension plan, the participants or beneficiaries in those received in retirement benefits do not get Social Security. They had no COLA.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, 10, 12, 13 years ago, there was a lot of our first our firefighters and first responders that were making $300 a month benefits for pension.
Sure.
And that's poverty level. So the city instituted the cost of living adjustment. Then you had the crash. You had 9/11. All kinds of things happened. And that really hurt.
Let me bring Michael Hallett in from the University of North Florida. Who's on the hook for the unfunded liabilities that, for instance, the Jacksonville Police and Fire Pension has, and more generally, these municipal unfunded liabilities?
Well, of course, good morning, local taxpayers are. I think from a state perspective, the challenge is that just that, that municipalities, the interest of municipalities are in some cases contradict the interest of the state. And so the challenge for local taxpayers is, for example, in Jacksonville, we have a home rule issue where the state has imposed a cap on how much localities in Jacksonville can increase its taxes. And so the police and fire pension fund debt in Jacksonville is in part driven by a longer standing failure to pay into the police and fire pension fund at the levels that were agreed to contractually.
Right. And this is the pay-as-you-go kind of model. And Carol Wiesert with the Leroy Collins Institute, a number of municipalities have pension plans where they contribute this year what they're going to pay out this year. They're not contributing this year what they're going to pay out in 2017, 2018, 2019, 2027, 2028, and years ahead. Does that formula need to change at the state level for municipalities to not essentially threaten future taxpayers with future tax hikes?
Yes, and I do think it's important to say that while Jacksonville is in trouble, there are a number of municipalities around the state that are actually in fine fiddle, if you will. But the issue at the state level basically regards a state law that was passed in 1999, and it sets aside the premium tax dollars to go for police and fire union pensions. But there's a proviso that basically that has to be provided for new benefits. It's a little complicated, but more than that. But that's basically the bottom line. And so there's an incentive for this applies to the police and local police and fire unions to provide more benefits rather than and they are not able to use that money to fill in when they have liabilities greater than their assets. So the bill that's in the legislature and that's been here a couple of years, and this is the third time it's been around, would give the local pensions, the local governments and local pension plans more flexibility to use those dollars to help them get out of this mess that some of them are in and really look forward to the future.
Matt Carlucci, you're a former Jacksonville City Councilman. Is that flexibility desired on the part of municipalities like Jacksonville? In other words, do they want to accept more of that responsibility with that flexibility?
Explain what the flexibility was again.
Well, the flexibility that is in the state pension reform legislation that's pending in Tallahassee.
Well, I'm not real familiar with that, but I do know this. The legislature primarily runs the Florida Pension Plan. The Florida Pension Plan is in good shape. It's 86% funded.
That's the state plan for state workers.
That's the state plan for state workers and county workers.
Mm-hmm.
And primarily because they overfunded the plan back in the 70s and the 80s in anticipation that sometime they could become underfunded or the budget could be in bad shape. The city of Jacksonville's plan has more detours, has more players to bargain with, and that's what makes it more difficult. And whether that can be changed or not, I don't know. But I will say this: there are about 259 local government plans that are funded below 80%, and about 232 plans that are funded above 80%. And we're unfortunately we're like 43% unfunded.
So much lower than what economists and financial advisors would advise.
We're not in real good shape.
Michael Hallett, finally from you, University of North Florida, you follow criminology and criminal justice. Is there an impact on service ultimately when pensions are underfunded as they are in Jacksonville?
Absolutely. The attrition rate, people are leaving, public safety workers are leaving their agencies in record numbers. The problem in Jacksonville is that there's a proposal currently being floated to pay new employees considerably lower benefits than current employees. So you'd essentially have a two-tier structure of benefits within the same agency. And I think it's a kind of a flawed logic to assume that new employees are going to come to help pay off those benefits, unfunded liabilities from previous years.
Michael,
the other problem in Jacksonville is that we have such a high crime rate.
We'll leave it there. Michael Hallett, University of North Florida. We've got Matt Carlucci, former Jacksonville City Councilman. Still more here to come, including the promise of a pension at the end of that working career. But some top Florida lawmakers are going to be working this spring on a series of bills designed to open up career opportunities, especially for people with disabilities. It's a personal issue for some in the legislature. Lynn Hatter reports from WFSU in Tallahassee.
Finding a job is hard. It can be more difficult with a disability involved. But Senate President Andy Gardner says it doesn't have to be that way. And he believes the state should take the lead on employment.
You know, we've made an effort over the last couple of years to help individuals with, a lot of people say disabilities, but we look at it as individuals with unique abilities.
For Gardner, the issue was personal. He has a son with Down syndrome, and he's fought for years to increase educational and employment opportunities for Floridians with disabilities. Gardner wants to help people like 21-year-old Ashley Martin. She spoke with Agency for Persons with Disabilities Director Barbara Palmer about a year ago. Ashley dreams of one day working with animals, but she's frustrated with the entry-level jobs she's gotten, such as working at a local grocery store.
You know the FSU food court thing? I forgot what it's called. Mm-hmm.
What kind of jobs did you do?
Inside jobs, like stocking stuff at Harvey's, cleaning tables at the FSU thing, and sweeping and putting new paper towels in the paper towel thing.
You didn't enjoy that?
Mm-mm.
What would you rather be doing?
Being outside with nature.
I think it's going to be a really good year for our cause under the leadership of Senate President Gardner.
Susan Homott heads the ABLE Trust. The organization lobbies for people with disabilities, and Homott says she can't remember a year where there have been so many bills.
I think we've got a great start. Obviously, most of the bills have been already authored and have been drafted, so we're taking a look at them, but even if a percentage of those bills pass, it will be a great year for people with disabilities in the state of Florida.
Florida lawmakers have started moving proposals that would allow disabled Floridians to work and keep their health insurance. Another would encourage state agencies to hire more people with disabilities. Other proposals expand workforce training opportunities at public universities. Still, there are problems. Other advocates say they need more funding for behavioral specialists who assist disabled Floridians on the job. They say once a person is employed, the specialist is there to help them navigate social situations, which can sometimes be overwhelming. Transportation is also a big hurdle to employment. And the ABLE Trust's Homott says she'd like to see further reductions in the red tape that people encounter when they try to enter the workforce.
We make life more difficult for them than we would ever make for ourselves. And it's just not fair. In fact, it's probably immoral. And I do say that to some people, you know, it's just not the human thing to do, you know. But we do make it difficult, you know.
But despite the downsides, Homott says all the legislation equals a big step forward. And she credits Senate President Andy Gardner for pushing the issue. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter in Tallahassee.
Still to come on our program, a new push for more legal medical uses for marijuana in Florida. As the Sunshine Edition, the 2015 Florida Legislature continues here from Florida Public Radio.